This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 11th of October, 1951. The title of this lecture is Axioms 33 to 49. This lecture is 59 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
I hope you don't hold the epicenter theory against me. Second part of tonight's lecture, I'll show you how this fits in on the tone scale, how you can use it, and in addition to that, what straight wire can be developed with self-determinism processing. You know, it's quite remarkable the results you can get in self-determinism processing without obviously hitting any effort. As a result, I think that an auditor can probably get better results, much better results, with just plain, ordinary self-determinism straight wire than he could get with the old techniques. Just that. I have seen people's reality come up so fast on self-determinism straight wire that the amount of daylight and so forth that they would suddenly begin to take in frankly blind them. You know, perception is a direct index of the amount of ability and alertness of the mind. Perception, not necessarily the recall of perception. If anybody has a shut-off recall basis, however, his perception is certainly down from what it could be. First part of tonight's talk, we'll take up as many of these axioms as we can skid along. You'll find out later on here, as soon as these early points are clarified, that these axioms, as far as you're concerned, get to be pretty humdrum, because you've seen this phenomena, the engram, unconsciousness, and so forth. Well, what we're covering here is a higher level of simplification than these others. Let's see, where'd we leave off last night? Thirty-three is conclusions are directed toward the inhibition, maintenance, or acceleration of efforts. That shows up in self-determinism very markedly. Self-determinism could be said to be a mechanism which puts or postulates the conclusions and puts them into action. Therefore, when you start to hit conclusions, the separating out of what are your conclusions and what were somebody else's seems to be best accomplished mostly by just finding out which ones were yours, not worrying too much about somebody else's conclusions. You find that theta facsimiles could be seen to be combined. The theta facsimiles are actually this pictures the messed universe and so forth, and they combine by similarities and differences and so on. You get various conclusions out of them by just a more or less a yay-nay index system. And after you've summed up a lot of these, a conclusion jumps out. Well, every conclusion is a static. The theta facsimiles are action, but the conclusion is a static in each case. Quite important to recognize the difference between a datum and a conclusion, because a datum is probably more tends over into the action level. But when it is held up to be a separate datum, hidden right behind it is the statement I have come to the conclusion that this is a separate datum. So that too is a conclusion. But data by itself in an unconcluded form is in motion. Theta facsimiles themselves containing motion are themselves in motion. When a conclusion is postulated by the individual, he postulates a static, and he thereafter receives the effect of that static. Whatever that static is, his future motion is moderated by that static. That's because he's traveling along a time track. Earlier statements have more force than later statements. We know this, by the way, in hypnotism. We give somebody a hypnotic command, and we tell him that he is now never going to be able to spit or something sensible like hypnotists use. And we find out if we hypnotize him the next day, we tell him, now you will find that you're doing nothing but spitting 24 hours a day, somewhat like hypnotists use. And then we find out that second command is inoperative. It is held in suspension by the first conclusion. Now, therefore, first things first, and that's where one gets this idea. In theta perception, or perceptics or facsimiles, the earlier perceptic takes precedence. This is not true of effort. This is only true of facsimiles. As a consequence, the exhausting of facsimiles out of engrams is possible without hitting any of the efforts. But to exhaust those facsimiles, you have to go to the earliest part of the track and start exhausting the perceptics on the earliest part of the track, because these perceptics, you see, are really just theta facsimiles, and you have to exhaust the earliest ones that you find on the track. And then you come later and later, and you get too late on the time track, and you find that an individual's perceptics are actually set. They're fixed. These perceptions all by themselves are tending to become conclusions. And they're set. And unless you've hit the earlier perceptics, the later perceptics are not reducible or erasable. But if you hit the early perceptics, they'll erase. Now, that is in the field of perception. However, perception is wrapped up in effort. And it doesn't matter how late or how early an effort is. It apparently will reduce anywhere on the track. It's a physical motion. It is actually on a very, very early basic, and it's very, very easily changed. I dare say I wouldn't make this experiment offhand just to be making it, but I dare say that somebody could take hold of somebody and run out his last operation in terms of effort processing. You get all the effort out of it, feel fine. Just postulating that is true. I have not taken late effort engrams and run them. This would be very fortunate if it were true, since one could then take such a thing as a delivery. And he could take then a series of deliveries of children on a woman. He could take five in some cases, including her own birth, and just determine that that's what should be run and go run it as a package of effort. Wouldn't matter much whether he hit the last one or the first one, her own birth and her four children, or the fourth child and then her birth, so on. Whatever would be attainable. Because by the perceptic filing, it's filed very definitely according to time. And you see why this is. Perceptions have much more intimately contained in them time. Perceptions have time in them because every perception includes time. So therefore, perceptions, it's really very simple when you look at it, perceptions which contain time are apt to obey the laws of time. Whereas effort, as such, is not necessarily dependent upon perception. It's dependent upon actual basic motion. And because an automobile went backwards today, there's no reason it won't go forwards tomorrow. muscular effort is just as mechanical as that, just as mechanical as any mist, because it's almost pure mist. There's very little theta in it. It wraps up theta, though. You can take a lot of effort, and you'll find out there are several tricks you can do. You'll find the perceptive spilling out of the effort. You take somebody who has one of these anxiety stomachs. You can pull a very interesting trick there. You can go through in a very heroic type of processing if you want to. You just tell him to lie down on the couch. Now, imagine the position of the middle of his body is this way or that way, whatever way it is. What way do you think the position of the middle of your body is in? So, well, I'm lying right here on the couch. No, what position was it in then? Can you get a then imagination of where it is? And you get some vague idea that it may be over a little bit. So you just say, all right, now move it back. Move the then perception back. And he'll start to move the then perception back into place, and it'll make him wriggle around, and he'll lose contact with it. So get the then perception of his feet, and the then perception of his hands, and then the then perception on his stomach again. If you keep this up, you will gradually knock the effort out of an engram which hasn't even been perceived. But you can very naturally expect, right in the middle of all of this, to have something very interesting happen. The perceptions fall out of the effort. Just bong, and there's recall. Well, this is particularly true if the individual is in a state of obedience where his stomach is, he normally would be. Of course, it's a static, or he wouldn't be stopped there. I did this to a salesman who foolishly came and knocked at my door. And he looked down and in a very puzzled tone of voice says, "A Confederate belt buckle." We went ahead and exhausted the Confederate belt buckle, and he felt much better. And his stomach hasn't kicked back on him since. Now, he had no idea what was happening to him, but it was just that process. He went away and wondered where that Confederate belt buckle had come from. But he didn't have as much question about it as you would have thought. Something sort of clicked through and said, it's all right. I don't imagine, though, he's going around telling his fellow salesman, you know, the other day I called it a house. A fixed muscular position, then, is like a conclusion. The muscles did this and this and this and this and then got to this state and stopped. And you have stops on the track with these. And the same way happens with theta perceptics. They get this way and this way and this way and this way. Because you see, they're dependent upon motion, but they're not intimately connected with motion. That is to say, they can be handled regardless of the motion that is actually in them. You, for instance, can think about a train running down the track, and you don't at the same time have to carry the track under your arm or so forth while you watch it. In other words, the perception will operate independent of the effort. But the effort always is in existence preceding a perception. There must be an effort to have a perception. Axiom 33A, the common denominator of all life organisms is motion. You find that's true of grass or trees or even the bum on the park bench. Here we have a common denominator. Therefore, if you want a common denominator to all illness, psychosomatic illness, and so forth, that common denominator is motion. And if you want to hook it up to the mind, it becomes effort. Motion, you see, can exist without being hooked up to a mind. It can't exist. You volcano blows up, there's motion. The fellow is dead, and the undertaker comes along and puts him on the marble slab, wiggles his arms and legs around, there's motion. But it's not connected to that person's mind. You take any living organism, you can move it around without the consent or the disagreement of the mind, too. rendered unconscious, something of the sort. You can reposition the limbs and so on. So motion is possible, but the kind of motion that we're interested in is motion which is connected to a mind, and that's effort. Effort is sort of measured motion. Measured, monitored motion. Axiom 33b, the effort of an organism towards survive or succumb is physical motion of a life organism at a given moment in time through space. Now, that is not very obscure. It just means that an effort has, as part of its theta facsimile, actually has a moment in time and a position in space. If a fellow is operated upon, hooked up in that operation someplace, are all the tabs of position and time. And then this theta facsimile, however, can be so wrapped up in effort that the perceptions of it are missing, including the time and space perception. Therefore, it can drift and float around, and it can get into present time, and so on. He can lift it into present time without knowing what it is and go on fighting it for years. And it belongs back on the time track someplace. And the second that you can assign it time and space, it really ceases to be very aberrative. The fellow recognizes where it is. He sees that it's where it is. He's proven it to himself that that's where it belongs. After that, it's not very aberrative. Actually, the whole process of erasure may only be getting enough effort out of one of these engram facsimiles so that the individual can no longer hold it out of position, and it'll sort of snap back into position. And that may be what the phenomena of erasure and reduction are. Although I believe that there's more to it than that. That is part of it. I think you're actually taking apart the whole theta facsimile when you really get an erasure. Doesn't matter too much what happens. As long as you can get rid of them, they never turn up again. Definition. Motion is any change in orientation in space. Here's this ashtray there, now it's there. It has to have gone through a motion in order to make this transit from one position to another. All motion contains time. Contains time. That's the trouble with it. Time is an arbitrary. And therefore, every time somebody comes along and tackles motion, he's bumping his nose into an arbitrary. Now, he can handle the space all right. He can move things around in space. So he conceives that because he could move things in space, he can also move things in time. Now, it may be high on the tone scale. This is possible, move things in time, but along the tone scale, it's not. As a consequence, somebody comes along and he tries to shove something someplace else. He's shoving right straight against time. It may very well be that an individual is determining the span of his own life by the action which he undertakes during it, because he's absorbing time into his facsimiles. Time and more time, and he puts physical effort into those facsimiles. You know, the Swedish calisthenics, had a call, and army close order drill, and other therapeutic measures are very interesting in their real activity. You take a college athlete, poor guy. He gets in there and he trains and he trains and he trains, and then people talk to him about when he's 32 or something like that, going around selling bonds. It has an enlarged heart, they say, or he's this or he's that or he's something else, but he's in bad shape. You want to start checking up on athletes who have ceased to be athletes, look them over, and you'll find out you're a relatively unhealthy crew, much too early in life. Well, these fellows have done two things. They have introduced a lack of randomity into their motions. They've routinized their motions, which is a static. You see, they've gone through training motions, which were you pick up the dumbbell here and you put it down there. You pick it up there and put it down here and you put it back there. You swing on the rings and you go through just exactly what this evolution is. Fellow keeps that up too long, it becomes a static. And as a result, because he was under strain and tension during that moment of exercise, the strain and tension of a static now stays with him right straight on through. You see how this could be. He gets out there, he goes through routine motions. He gets tired after a while, and he still goes through routine motions. The coach says, "I'll coach Big Paunch, you know," and smoking a thick cigar and so on. He says, "Now get in there." He says, "I'll show those fellows they're not going to intimidate me," and so on, and urges them on. The guys will get tireder and harder. Keep right on going. You're not going to let me get licked on the situation. That's the sort of an action they go through. And I'm telling you this for a very good reason, is you will find in people which you treat a very large number of men and women who have been highly athletic, who have trained up in this line. For heaven's sakes, exhaust the effort out of that. Don't avoid it, because it is supposed to be healthy. Sure enough, it probably is healthy. It has a short time value. The healthiest part of it, though, is the full belief of the individual in engaging in these activities that they will make him healthy. And then after he gets away from this postulate for a while, the actual real basic starts to turn up, and he starts to get an enlarged heart. What's an enlarged heart? You start worrying with barbells long enough, like Harold Teen, and the next thing you know, his heart is pumping hard. It's hard work, and the action in the heart will build it up to what it thinks is a necessary capacity, and then it's got too much capacity. Interesting things can be done physiologically. During the war, I saw a young man taken into a hospital who had an enlarged heart, and the doctor made him build up an athletic schedule to the point it had been built up to when he was in college. And, oh, it was a lot of work. This took about 3 years, by the way. I heard a final report on it about 1947. I liked this kid a lot. He was a nice guy. Belonged to the Army, but he's still a nice guy. And I got in there and talked to him for a while. And what are you doing? Well, every morning I have to go out on a 2-mile walk. And in the afternoon I run around the track 6 times. Then I take a turn in the gym, and then I swim for a quarter of a mile. That was finally what he worked his routine up to. He built his physical strength back to the enlarged heart. Now, he was, of course, going to be all right because he's in balance, but the only trouble is, after 3 years of this sort of thing, he had quit it, and here he was in another static, and he was declining some more. Now, this is, it should be of interest to you, because you will note this to be wrong with people. Remember that a static can be formed by routine action. You take somebody who's had to do sentry go in the cold, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, day in and day out. Maybe he was at this for 2 years. And if he was up in some place like Argentia or something of the sort doing this kind of sentry go, you will find that he's gotten himself in a little bit of bad shape. He has chills. He's got a static. A static which he's fallen in through repeating the same motion over and over, and as a result, he has overdeveloped in all fronts. He has overdeveloped also a static, so that he tries to go on down the time track from this spot, he carries right along with it the chill, the aching feet, the hollow in his shoulder for the musket and everything. He'll carry this right on down the track with him. You'll pick him up as an auditor, and he'll say, "Well, I guess it's because I took to drink when I was 12 or something." And this knockout, that effort of sentry go. Force is random effort. Force does not have, according to physics, direction, unless you have applied force, which has direction. Physicists can argue around about this, but this is the definition which we can take. Force is random effort. And effort is directed force. So you see, in our definition of effort, we have the fellow postulating a direction, an amount of force, and in that we have effort. And that's what we mean exactly by effort. Axiom 34, an organism's effort can be to remain at rest or persist in a given motion. Now here again you have statics and motion on a reduced scale. You'll find out that injuries are incurred by organisms when they are at rest and resist moving, or when they are moving and get stopped. So that either one violates the self-determinism of the organism. The fellow says, I'm going to stand here, and somebody comes along and gives him a shove. The individual's effort was to remain in a state of rest. Somebody came along and tried to interrupt his self-determinism. Or this fellow is walking along in this direction and somebody stops him. This other person has interrupted his self-determinism. Now, this is a very important axiom. It doesn't appear so. Better put a couple of stars after, because it's very important. It's something that you might overlook. This is actually the basis of self-determinism. It's whether a person's going to remain at a state of rest in face of all hostile forces, or whether he's going to be able to remain in a state of motion despite all hostile forces. And when counter efforts interrupt his effort to remain at rest or his effort to remain in motion, his self-determinism is undermined just to that extent. So long as he does not succumb to being stopped and started and stopped and started. In other words, as long as he himself does not say to himself, well, I mustn't move in that direction because I'll be stopped. As long as he does not say to himself, I must not stand still because I will not be permitted to stand still. And he agrees, why, he's all right. But when he agrees, that's too bad. Now, theta, therefore, has its own force. It isn't just all stimulus response. It postulates something, and it says, I must continue and persevere in life regardless of any of this. And a man can be knocked around most alarmingly until he all of a sudden agrees that he's being knocked around. And then he agrees which direction he's being knocked around. Then he agrees on what he mustn't do to get knocked around. And when he's gone all through this gamut, he's practically done for. You as an auditor pick him up on the basis of when he agreed that he'd get stopped every time he moved, or when he agreed that he would be moved every time he tried to come to a state of rest. You can work from that point, and then you can work to the minor points of the matter, which is when he felt that he would be if he did. That's about all you need to get. If a man is really pretty daffy about it, you course, get in there and just exhaust the effort. Just exhaust a few of these times when he was stopped. Get an earlier period there when he made an effort to stand still, and he made an effort to keep in motion. Get the efforts to stand still in motion, exhaust those as such. You'll find perceptics flying out of this fellow's track just like 4th of July if you start working on those two efforts. You see, all obedience must have as its forerunner physical action, a counter effort against the individual, which will not permit him to stand still when he wants to, or will not permit him to move when he wants to. Obedience cannot be achieved without that. You take an individual and get him into a state of blind obedience, that's all you have to do to him. That is the reason for close order drill in the services. That's close order drill. It's the only real reason it's got. The formations of close order drill went out shortly after the War of 1812 as the usual thing, where you stood up in a column and drilled on a battlefield and wheeled around and fired by volley and so forth. Guns, rifles got better, and they didn't have to use men in this fashion. But armies have still continued the use of close order drill. There's nothing like that to... For instance, a first sergeant I have to write a manual sometime on how to be a first sergeant. I'll put it as one of the sub-pamphlets of Black Dianetics. The way you really want to get a company of men under control, you would think offhand so that you will have blind, instantaneous obedience. You think offhand that you do it on an ARC basis. No. No, because you've got to take all kinds of men. You take the esprit and let that be handled on an ARC basis, another echelon, and then you, as the sergeant or the officer, stand aside from that ARC. That's the service. That's the flag. Those are symbols, that sort of thing. You are my mess, as far as I'm concerned, and you hate me, but you love that flag. This is the way they do it. Unfortunately, war and such activities of war do not have enough time element in them to permit anything like ARC. And what is a static? It is something with no time in it. So in order to work in a field where there's no time, you have to create statics. Very simple. You have to create statics. You tell a bunch of men to jump up on that parapet and charge. And they jump up on the parapet and charge. It was a foolish thing to do. There's machine guns over on the other side and so on. But these guys will still jump up on the parapet and charge. That's the mystery. They use no self-determinism with regard to those machine guns at all. A regiment, a division, will pour itself into a slaughterhouse action where their casualties will be 80 or 90%, where every man there and every officer there knows the general has given them the wrong order. And the briefer the time span demanded, the greater the tendency toward a static. This is why accidents and so forth have so many holders in them right before the accident. It's an emergency. The fellow takes all the time out of it and tries to act. And he'll stick himself on the track. Also, there's something else that should be remarked there. The delivery of bad news, the delivery of bad tidings, or the delivery of a blow, these are all the same thing. The bad tidings are just symbols of a blow. If delivered, delivered on a shortest possible time span will produce the maximum drop on the tone scale. When you shorten the time span of the delivery of bad news or a blow, you increase the amount of drop on the tone scale to the individual to which it's delivered. That is an important axiom. And it's probably not even in here, but one of the reasons it's not in here is this tells you how to knock a man, an organization, or a country into apathy with the greatest amount of dispatch. Don't deliver 5 bombs, 1 a day. Deliver 5 bombs on 5 cities in the same 5 minutes. You'll produce apathy. If you drop a bomb today on 1 city and tomorrow on another city, so on, you may still produce something like apathy. But if you drop a bomb today and you drop a bomb next week and you drop a bomb the week after that and you spread it out to 5 weeks, at the end of 5 weeks you have the country fighting mad. They haven't dropped, you see, on the tone scale. So to create a static, what you do is create an emergency situation. Maximal destruction in minimal time produces the maximum drop on the tone scale. Now, this is something a sergeant uses. He goes in, he gets a couple of guys out of bed. They were sassy to him at retreat or something of the sort. And he says, go dig a ditch. And they say, what? And he says, go dig it. It's just 2 o'clock in the morning. Bow, bow, dig a ditch. Completely out of order. It has nothing to do with reason. It's utterly unreasonable. And they go dig their ditch. And they come back. The whole company begins to buzz and boil about it and so forth. And one guy, he gets pretty uppity. But this guy, oddly enough, has a dirty rifle. So the sergeant takes the rifle, looks it over carefully, and puts it in his tent and gives the guy a deck court-martial or something like that for having lost his rifle, anything. Completely arbitrary. It doesn't have any way you can assault reason with force produces a static. Just assault reason with force and you'll produce a static. Now, the speed and savageness and suddenness of the production of that static measures the amount of reduction on the tone scale. In the same way, good news or something which lifts or exalts individual produces the maximum rise on the tone scale by being given in the minimum time. It is, again, a static. So you see, it's the static's the thing. Everybody says, armistice has been signed. Whistles go all over town. Everybody takes off like a rocket, you see. You formed a static. Sudden news, minimum time of delivery, so on. Everybody will go on up the stars. But now tell them tomorrow, well, that wasn't the static. This is now the static. And you'll get a little response. Now, that isn't just invalidation at work. That is the mechanism of invalidation. Now, the next day you come along and you tell somebody something good, and you try to tell them quickly and so forth, but you've spread all sorts of stuff across a time span, and as a consequence, the amount they'll go up the time track is very small. If you can just take good news or something like that and just unload it on people's heads suddenly, they'll sit there stunned for an instant. You formed a static. They will proceed on their time tracks from that moment on with this static in mind. That is how to rabble rouse. I've never tried it very much. There are really two kinds of statics. One is motion of attention unfixed. This is the statics of attention. Unfixed but sweeping attention. Sweep, 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 sweep. Unfixed. You can get a guy to where he'll sweep his attention like that, and that becomes a static. Why? Because it doesn't fix on anything. It doesn't mark anything happening. It doesn't mark anything going by. You'll find psychotics doing this or fixing their attention on one object and not sweeping. Motion, then, for the mind, depends upon the attention not being too widely unfixed or too sharply fixed. See, there'd be that difference. Now, that is of use in such things as radar. You get a fellow sitting down looking at a radar PPI scope, and this thing swings, 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 swings monotonously. That's a static. Because it's repeated motion, and here is attention of that radar is unvarying. He's watching something which has an unvarying attention, and he's keeping a fixed watch on it. He himself is put in the position of a static. He is told to keep his attention static, and he watches something which by its cyclic repetition of sweep is itself static. And he becomes static. And I have seen men lag on the report of a pip on radar quite a long time. They'll sit there and they just won't register it. See? Guy's in the static. He isn't in motion. All you'd have to do is make your sweep random. Sweep of the radar random. Like this, and occasionally make it fix on something. And then the guy will sit there and he'll watch it and he won't go out like a light. Very simple. By the way, they've been trying to solve this in Washington. Why don't you write in? Axiom 35, the ultimate goal of Lambda is infinite survival. Rather obvious. 36, death is the abandonment by Theta of a life organism or race or species where these can no longer serve Theta in its goal of infinite survival. You'll find, oddly enough, that death is self-determined. Death is self-determined. Guy looks at his body and says, boy, I'm sure chopped up. This motor can't run, so he shuts off the whole machine. Now, a fellow thinks he's going to stop this motion while he's injured. He tries to stop the motion of pain and so forth, and he'll hang himself up on the track. Now, if you get some poor luckless devil who sits around and has somebody in his environment that he's trying to stop with words, he finds out he can't stop them, he'll stop himself. Something very important for you in therapy. Where an individual has been unable to control emotions of someone in his environment that he thought he ought to control, he will begin to try to stop that person or start that person vocally by action one way or the other, and he will wind up in postulating these emotions. The recognition that he can't affect them will cause him to go into a static. The reason why, of course, is because he's starting to stop motion out here, and it comes right back in, and he winds up by starting and stopping motion in himself. So he'll get into a static. You'll find people group in the vicinity of people that they cannot control. Now, take that advisedly on control. An individual who is in good ARC with another person won't try to control him, but let him go out of ARC with somebody else who is still in his environment, and he will try to start and stop this person in some fashion. And the effort to start and stop this individual cannot be physically applied. It's against the law in this society. This society is a great society. It's really set up for statics. You can't go poke anybody in the nose. As a result, your efforts to stop them or start them in some particular direction result in you stopping yourself, because you are the closest physical contact you've got. Just the postulation that he must stop stops you to that degree. You check this over with pre-clears. You'll find this is a fascinating one. Trying to stop and start mama. Trying to stop and start pets. The fellow just goes into a spin on it finally, and he gets a static right there, and then he'll say, well, I'm no good. I can't control myself, obviously, because I can't control mama. He loses control of himself because he can't control the other, because when he tried to control the other, he's trying to control himself. He didn't notice at the moment. He was also trying to start and stop himself, and he was trying to start and stop mama. Did you ever see anybody trying to feed a little baby? You know, they take the spoon and they put it in the little baby's mouth. The little baby says, So they think. I was in a restaurant one day. Howard Johnson's, and there was a little baby being fed at the center table. The manager put this baby right in the center of the whole dining room, and Mama was trying to feed this baby with a spoon, and Mama was going, trying to get baby to open its mouth. Unconsciously, Papa was doing the same thing. I looked around the other table, and about a third of the people there were... You see the mechanism. They try to get the baby to open its mouth, and they open theirs. Try to stop somebody, you stop yourself. Take a moral lesson from that. Leave the Republicans alone. All right. The reward of an organism engaging upon survival activity is pleasure. Pleasure is actually a sufficient randomity of motion to not produce a static. That is to say, we'll get into that in a moment, but there would be completely monotonous motion, repeated motion, that is a static, and no motion is a static. So therefore, pleasure must lie between a monotonous motion and a static of no motion. In other words, it lies between two statics, and you see immediately that that has to contain randomity. I will go into that in a moment. Pleasure is obtainable then in overcoming minor uncertainties with facing various forces and so forth, the continuance of effort in the direction of survival. And if a person goes along in a non-static way, he could be said to be experiencing pleasure. The penalty of an organism failing to engage upon survival activity or engaging on non-survival activity is pain. Well, pain, interesting mechanism. Some engineers, I understand, were trying to study what pain was, and they finally found out you give a person an electric shock, he'd get over his pain. That's fine. I imagine the auditor that came along afterwards, after he'd run out the shock, could get at the original pain in order to run that out. Pain is a randomity, peculiar characteristics, but it's maximal motion in minimal time and causing a misalignment of the atoms and molecules in the organism. It introduces a forceful, authoritative wave which goes counter to all of the body's motions and actions. And it cancels out motion on the part of the body in too short a span of time. That we call pain. Pain is actual and physical at the moment of receipt and is then a theta facsimile. The fact that a theta facsimile was made of it had been overlooked. People don't even know, do you know that people can recall pain? People out in the society don't realize that. Give you some kind of an idea how far we are ahead. I was talking to some fellow the other day that needed Dianetics. Boy, he even needed it the worst way. Of course, I'd never give it into the hands of some, I know, but he could have used processing. And he said, what is this Dianetics all about? And I said, well, found out that life is an energy which gets stored as pain and so forth. Moment of impact, when you've experienced pain once, why it stores it. And then later on it exerts it on the body. And his ears went up like a mule's and they waved and I almost got cool in the breeze. He was very interested. Brand new concept as far as he was concerned. As a matter of fact, it's an incorrect statement. Pain is not stored as an energy. It can't be. But sounds logical to them. Then you don't have to tell them about theta and theta facsimiles and this and that. The cell, better change this in your book. The cell and slant or virus are the primary building blocks of life organisms. Unless you want to consider theta facsimiles as the primary building block. It's all the same to me. Axiom 40, the virus and cell are matter and energy animated and motivated in space and time by theta. That's something that you as an auditor should take cognizance of. It's interesting to this effect that you can start running back the theta facsimiles of individual cells. Some fellow's having a lot of trouble with a particular portion of his body. You can process that portion of his body and run it on the time track to find the cell injury facsimiles rather than the organism injury facsimiles. You'll find some of the most interesting things. That's a fact, though. They're cell facsimiles. There's a nervous system in a monocell. Monocell is a very advanced animal, actually. Although it divides, it procreates by division and so forth, it's got a complex anatomy. It's pretty well developed already. When you say a cell is the basic building block. If you were to think of a monocell as being a basic building block of life, you have started already at much too high an echelon of complexity because a monocell is a very complex animal. It's got a nervous system. It thinks, obviously thinks. You can run tests on monocells and you find out that you can train them to avoid pain sources and so on. Fascinating work. The field of biology has never done any of this work to amount to anything. Once in a while, somebody will come along and make some comment on the behavior of growth. But it never seems to have occurred to anybody that all you have to do is take monocells and you can train them. Of course, it's a little bit more of an artistic job than is done by the owner of a flea circus, but it's much on the same order of magnitude. Training a monocell to jump, to go to the other side. In particular, you take germ cells of various diseases. They're mobile. And you can fix them up so that they can be conditioned to run away from green water. You can tint the water green with something which is irritant, and they'll go away from it. And then you put a green in the water which is not an irritant, they'll go away from it. It's very interesting. But the work is so delicate, so difficult to do, that the results are only as a result of many, many, many experiments. It's just, in the first place, your own credulity is fighting you, that something could actually perceive to this degree, so it could take survival courses of its own. But your reason should tell you immediately that something which is a live organism, which can't take survival actions, would of course be a dead organism, so it isn't there. Number 41, theta mobilizes the virus and cell in the colonial aggregations to increase potential motion to accomplish effort. You can see that the body building themselves together, colonial. People were looking at the reverse side of this thing. They said to avoid pain or something or so on, or to fight its enemies or to get away from something. You could just see the people on the tone, where they were on the tone scale, were inventing these theories. They said that the cells got together into colonial aggregations and developed teeth or something. Now, there's a dynamic goal, and if you don't look at the other side of it to see that they're getting together in order to handle more physical universe, you have no forward motion, nothing. That postulates a static, but it must have been postulated by people who were pretty static. 42, the goal of virus and cell survival in space through time, it's the same as the organism. The total mission of higher organisms, virus and cells, is the same as that of the virus and cell. In other words, we've got a type of life, no matter what form it is in, it's doing pretty much the same thing. And that's very interesting, because those two axioms, axiom 42 and axiom 43, were the earliest axioms in Dianetics. They go back to 1933. They sat there for a long time without anything else happening. The obvious, more or less stated in just those words. Goal of virus and cell is survival in space through time. The total mission of higher organisms, virus and cells, the same as that of virus and cells. 44, colonial aggregations of virus and cells can be imbued with more theta than they inherently contained. That's new. That was not back then. Those two are, I have a sentimental attachment for. Axiom 45. Well, let me mention this 44 because it's very... That is the one thing you must know in group Dianetics or in examining personality, is that there seems to be more theta attracted to the thing. Now, this could be seen to be a static forming new facsimiles of action, too. Here you have a full body at work, and so you get facsimiles of what the full body is doing, so therefore the body has an identity because there's a full facsimile of it. And because it is a facsimile which is in common to every cell facsimile in the body, every cell could be coaxed to accept or would accept this major facsimile. And as a result, you would have facsimiles of the organism as a personality. The same thing would happen in a group. You get a theta facsimile of the group which everybody would begin to accept. There's not a matter of quantity here. It's a matter of overall facsimiles. Once those facsimiles accumulate, it's almost impossible to do anything about them. You've got a new static. In the formation of groups, then, great attention has to be paid to the formation of an organism along the lines of the rules of organisms. You can't form a group out of individuals and then treat them continually from there on as individuals, each one with separate goals. The organism itself has to have its own goals. As long as it's got its own goals, it's an organism. It also has to have nerve lines. It also has to have standard memory banks. In other words, if you're going to make a group successfully, you're going to have to obey the rules of an organism. And this is the axiom that takes care of that. Effort can be accomplished by lambda only through the coordination of its parts toward goals. Rather obvious. An organism is equipped to be governed and controlled by a mind. The evolution of a mind is a subject which is just barely mentioned in the first book on Dianetics. It talks about the impact system and is really talking about counter efforts. The effort of the body to absorb, channel, and use counter efforts resulted in a nervous system, a brain, a cushion of shock arrangement, and so forth for the body. But actually, you had theta facsimiles of this and all combined theta facsimiles going together, forming up the memory banks and actually the active mind of the organism. Now, this hooks in, evidently, into the nervous and control system. I don't think it'd be too hard to solve exactly where it hooks in, too. Purpose of the mind is to pose and resolve problems relating to survival and to direct the effort of the organism according to these solutions. Boy, were we back on familiar ground with that one. Axiom 48, all problems are posed and resolved through estimations of effort. And that's important to an auditor. Because how can an organism estimate effort unless it itself has experienced effort? And so it is. So that back of every calculation of effort is actual physical effort. And if you've got a calculation of effort in the organism that you consider to be aberrated, all you have to do is get the earlier physical effort out of it, and that thing will fold up. Because it is no longer able to operate as such, because you've knocked out part of the facsimile. You've disconnected the facsimile. 49, the mind can confuse position in space with position in time. My, if you just look at words which people use to describe time, you will find out how confused this language is. It's a long time. Time isn't long, it's a short time. So on and so on. They don't have any descriptive words for time, which is an indicator. They just use space words to describe time. And as a result, you can tell somebody to go down the time track. You can't go down a time track, you see. You travel through time along a time track, but you can't go a long time because you get the idea. The only way you can really contact time is through motion. As long as you address motion, you're on safe ground because motion's got time in it. When a person gets frozen up in a motion as a static, he's trying to do something about the motion, he then can't move in time because what's frozen in there and what's the arbitrary is the time. So this individual tries to move up and down his time track. He cannot handle motion, so he can't move on his time track. And the reason he can't move on his time track is because he can't handle motion. The reason he can't handle motion, he's stuck in a static about motion. If you take somebody that's been punching a drill press with this motion, day after day, week after week, year after year, and you all of a sudden get him for processing, if there's anything left of him to process, you will find out that this fellow is in a static. Very bad static. The reason why is he has lost in his job the ability to differentiate time because all the motions are the same. So the estimation of time, it depends upon the ability to observe changes in space. You observe changes in space, and so you estimate time. You know that it's been some time since you left your hometown because you go back and look. You know where you've been. The hometown looks exactly the same, only it's all different. Well, it's those differences that you measure that hometown by. The people, what's been built, what's been burned, what's been torn down. These changes permit you to observe what's happened to time in the interim. Thus, time is an arbitrary, is traced by the individual by changes in space or through motion. But you can't get any changes in space without getting motion. So you're on safe ground as long as you keep an individual all cleaned up on the subject of motion. The easiest way to do it, of course, is by the estimations of effort. Now, you'll note these axioms are coming out pretty obvious along about there. Tomorrow night I will give you, in the first hour, a description and talk on randomity. And now let's take a break.